Use the wireless. Thank you very much. All right, we'll get this other thing out of here before I trip over. Okay. What on earth was I talking about? We're talking about moving. When we move, we're going to be using a building to build people. Now, building the building is also part of building people, right? So the way we build it is important. I'm convinced that one of the reasons that the Lord is allowing us to experience some of the delays that we are is because that's a perfect learning experience. That's a perfect way that God can use that tool to help bring us to maturity. See, if everything goes the way we want it to go, and all of our expectations are satisfied, then we would grow to the place, or we would come to the place where we would end up wanting to use God for our advantage all the time. Things don't go the way we want them to go. You know, it's amazing to me. I was on my way over this morning, and here was this poor fellow, and he was in the car, and something wasn't going the way he wanted it to go. I mean, maybe the person in the car in front of him, or maybe the red light, or something wasn't working out the way he felt like it should be working out. And he was turning around the corner, and he was just shaking his head, and he was just mumbling, and he was just going on like that. I thought to myself, now there's a fella that expects the effects of sin to be suspended for him. You know, he expects this sin-cursed world to somehow work out differently than everybody knows from experience it's going to. This whole business of living life here on earth has to do with responding to the consequences of our selfish disobedience and not wanting God's way, but wanting our own way. And one of the frustrating things about that is, not only do we have the problems that we have because of that, the problems are worse because of that. That's why the problems bother us. So everything in life becomes a circumstance in which we have an opportunity to grow into what God wants us to be. I was talking with Joel about that last night and saying, now look, you know, ultimately, we're going to get in this building. It's a beautiful place. And thank the Lord for it. And thank the Lord for all the sacrifices that have been made. And that's a tremendous goal for us to strive for that. But ultimately, one of these days, we're going up and it's staying here. You see? It's a tool that we use to help some more people go up with us. You see? And let's remember that. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't important. It is important. There are an awful lot of things in life that are important that sometimes we treat as though they weren't important. And don't be good stewards. So we have to treat things with proper stewardship as though they were really important. But the ultimately important thing is how our hearts are related to God. That is extremely important. Every situation becomes a circumstance in which we can have a right response. Now, we say those things, and we would all say, yes, we agree with that. That's true. That's right. But then how do we live? How do we live when things don't go the way we expect them to go? You know, I've heard the jokes, and I listen to them myself, where people talk about Murphy's Law, and they talk about all those kinds of things as though, well, whatever can go wrong will. You know, as though that were a joke or something. That's not a joke. That's life. That's the result of the fall. That's not Murphy's Law. That's God's law. See? Now, the joke is that we expect that not to be. That we expect everything to work out for our good, according to our definition of good. You see? Well, everything is going to work together for good, according to God's good. Okay, Brother Sean Weiss, good to see you today. How are you? Good to have you here. Pastor from Kansas. All right, page 4, is that where we are? Are we on page 4 today? Did we get through 3? We talked about the deacons. Let me just explain that to you one more time, because we're getting ready to go through that here in just a few weeks about how we select deacons here. Look at D on page 3. Concerning deacons, the congregation shall select prospective deacons for approval by the pastors. Their qualifications are listed in 1 Timothy 3, 8 through 13. Now here's how that takes place. After having been interviewed by the pastors, those names receiving unanimous approval will be posted for 30 days. If you want to nominate somebody to serve as a deacon, then we'll have a nomination ballot. If we have like 10 fellows that we're electing to be deacon, we'll receive 10 or 12 or so nominations. And the fellows that receive the greatest number of nominations are set up according to the number of nominations that they receive. Let's say the guy that gets the most nominations gets 50, and the next guy gets 45, and the next guy gets 40, and so on. All right, we'll go through and we'll interview them from the top down until we find the number of candidates that are willing and eligible to serve that we need to put on the ballot, and then we'll stop. That's the way it works. It's just a practical way of doing it. Now, it could be that there'll be some good man that gets nominated to serve as deacon, but he only gets like 4 or 5 nominations, and there are enough fellows to serve that get more than that. That doesn't mean that we're having 2 elections. It means that we're looking for fellows who are already recognized as leaders because there are sufficient people to be willing to follow their leadership so that their service will be effective. Now, if there are not enough people who've nominated that individual, doesn't necessarily mean he's not qualified, doesn't mean he's not capable, doesn't mean he doesn't deserve an opportunity. It simply means that he has not established enough identity yet among enough people to really be effective at this point, as these other fellows have. So it's just a practical way of doing it. So we post those names for 30 days. The election should be held in a general business meeting. The term of office shall be for a period of 3 years. A majority of deacons should not be elected at one time. During that 30 days, if a man prayerfully looks at it and says, I just don't think I can do this, or I just don't think I ought to do it, or he may know something about his own situation that would cause him to need to wait. It may be that there's a situation in his life where he's not scripturally qualified, and he doesn't want to go into it. He doesn't want to discuss that publicly and have to go through all that. So he can quietly go back, cross his name off that list, and initial it. No questions asked. By the same token, the reason that we go through this process of the pastors evaluating is there may be some situation that's confidential that doesn't need to be broadcast among all the people, and the fellows can share that with the pastors and say, well, I have this situation going on right here, and it'd probably be a good idea for me if I didn't do that. Or what do you think? And we may say, well, we'd like for you to wait a while, or you know, you may understand that because of this situation right here, it'd be best for you to serve in some other capacity but not as a deacon, or something like that, you see. So that way we can deal with those things confidentially, and there's still an opportunity for a man, after he evaluates it, to come through and remove himself from nomination later. Deacons' authority and responsibilities are explained next. The deacons are servants. What does the word deacon mean? It means servant. The deacons are servants and have no scriptural authority to establish matters of policy. Okay? Now, that is not to be unkind. It's just to make it plain. A lot of times people get the idea that the deacons are like the corporate officers of the church, or that the deacons are fellows who are elected to run the business of the church, and that the deacons are kind of the board of directors, and they hire the pastor, and the pastor is sort of like the preaching janitor. You know what I mean? Now, in other words, that's the way it is in a lot of churches, you see. But that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that the spiritual authority is vested in those who are selected to be the teachers. And the way that authority is accomplished is through teaching. Now, remember, any man who tries to wield authority as a pastor who does it through any other means than teaching usurps his authority. Okay? Never forget that. The day may come when you'll have to select another pastor. Okay? Eventually, the Lord tarries. I suspect that's going to be true because people have a tendency to get old and die. Okay? But I don't have any other plans, but I want you to know that that's the reality of the fact. All right. Now, because that's true, you need to know what basic qualifications to look for, both in a pastor and in deacons. Now, what you want to look for in a pastor is a fellow whose authority is bound in his teaching. Sometimes you'll find a man who wants to put authority in his title, or who wants to put authority in his personality, or who wants to put authority in the fact that everybody has to listen while he talks, or something like that. No, the pastor's authority is in his teaching. That's how he accomplishes it. Where's the deacon's authority? In his service. It's in his service. How does he accomplish those things for which he is responsible? Primarily through being a servant. How does the pastor accomplish those things for which he's responsible? Primarily through teaching, you see. Now, again, anybody who tries to turn that thing upside down and use some other means is going to cause confusion. If the pastor tries to act like a corporate president, or the deacon tries to act like a board of directors, well, then we're bringing the world's methods into the church, and that's not going to be effective. Never will be effective on either count. So, they're not corporate officers. They shall function as practical ministers by taking care of the physical aspects of the ministry to free the pastors to give their full attention to their responsibilities as listed above, and by providing research and recommendation on committees when necessary. They are to serve, witness, preach, and contend with the faith as demonstrated in Acts 4 through 8. Now, I think a lot of times pastors may be a little bit reluctant to use deacons in the capacity that the Bible actually indicates they should be because of the tendency of carnal men to abuse the office. Now, we said the other day, it is wrong for a church to seek to control a pastor. The only thing that a church can do when a pastor loses the confidence of the people is either remove themselves from his leadership by leaving the church, or remove him from leadership by making him leave the church. Now, the church has that authority. You either get rid of him or get out from under his leadership, but you never try to do something to control him. Because when you do that, you put yourself in great danger. Great danger. By the same token, a deacon should not be manipulatively controlled by either the people or by the pastor. Okay? That kind of thing is a violation of brotherhood. It's a violation of fellowship. It's a violation of the true principle, biblical principle of transparency and accountability. You see, accountability is a whole lot better than authority, because accountability makes me responsible. It doesn't make somebody else responsible to make me do right. Yes, sir, Chris? What does an individual do if he knows that's going on? Okay, well, I would appeal to a brother. If you're in a situation where a person is trying to control the pastor and you're not the pastor, you know, I would go to the brother and I would appeal to him and I would seek to teach him the biblical principle. And I would hold him accountable for that disobedience just like I would any other disobedience. You know, brother, this is what the Bible teaches, and this is the way that that we're supposed to do this. And I'm troubled by this. And I don't want there to be a breach in our fellowship. Do you think the pastor's aware of the things that you're doing? Or does he understand that? Or something like that. And then I would hold him accountable. Let's say that he had done some other thing. Let's suppose that he lied about somebody. Well, the way that you deal with that is you'd go to him and say, you know, we got a problem here. I want to be able to give a good report, and I'm not going to be able to until we get this dealt with. So here's what we need to do. And then if the person won't be accountable, say, well, look, the next step is we've got to go and we've got to get some help here. So I'm going to check with you next week. And if we've got this thing worked out, fine. If not, well, then I'm going to go with you and talk to so-and-so. Well, I won't go with you. Well, then I'll go and talk to him myself. You just keep escalating the authority until you get to the people who can deal with it. I deal with it just like any other act of disobedience. Is that a good answer? Does that help? Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Yeah.
And what do you do? I mean,
okay.
You can't serve his authority.
Right. And you can't. Right.
Authority.
Right. It's difficult when you're in a situation where somebody is trying to usurp authority over the true leadership of the church, and you are a bystander and you're trying to help the leadership of the church. That's difficult, because if you defend the leadership wrongly, you weaken and undermine the leadership yourself. Generally speaking, in a situation where deacons are trying to control a church, there's some failure in the pastor's leadership or the pastor's teaching anyway. Otherwise, they wouldn't feel justified in being able to do that. Now, let me ask you something. You see the practical application of what we're talking about right here? What we're talking about right now is a potential problem and how to prevent it. Okay? Now, we don't have that problem here at Faith Baptist Church. How do I provide the basis for my leadership? Through teaching. All right? What am I doing right now? I'm teaching. What am I teaching you about? I'm teaching you about how to avoid this very problem. You see? Now, you know how a lot of pastors, bless their hearts, and I've got some friends who've done this, you know how they deal with the thing of deacon rebellion? They wait until it happens, and then they try to get the upper hand. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. That's just an arm wrestling contest. Yes, sir. Yeah, I know what you mean. That's right. Well, that's why. Right. That is a difficult situation. There are some situations where you haven't had enough opportunity yet to teach somebody who, because it just takes time. There's so many things that we all need to know from the Bible that unless a person is willing to listen to the teaching of a ministry or a Bible ministry for any length of time, they bring some wrong ideas with them, and can get themselves in trouble before they have a chance to be properly grounded and taught. That's one of the reasons that I think you need a well-grounded, well-identified teaching ministry so that people know what they're getting into from day one. Okay? Here at Faith Baptist Church, we strive for this. We don't always get to it, but we strive to let you know from the first day you come here that we teach the Bible here. You'll get more out of the messages if you bring your Bible with you and keep them open as we preach. You'll learn more if you'll take notes. Okay? And you'll find that the Bible changes people. Okay? And the more you teach the Bible, the more changes are accomplished in the lives of people. So if you let people know from the very beginning what they're in for, they have an idea of whether or not this they're going to fit there or not. Anyway, frankly, we haven't had very much of that over the years, of people who have enjoyed a great amount of authority and influence in another church, who for some reason have had a falling out with the leadership there and think that they're going to transplant that same concept into this ministry. The reason we haven't had very much of that is because from the first time they come, they get a heavy dose of the Bible, and that affects enough of a change in their life that it helps them, or it causes them to say, that's not what I want. You see? All right, we had several hands. Jeff? To a degree, yeah, everybody who has any kind of a job or ministry of service ultimately has a piece of the job of the person who's above him in the chain of command, so to speak. That's why all of us ultimately have a part of the Lord's work, you see. Yes, Crystal? Yeah, I think that'd be very important to do. And one of the things that we're practicing for as we talk about that in this class is something for new believers, new members, and people who have not been taught. One of the reasons we wanted to go through this material right here is because there's an awful lot of practical information that sometimes we assume the members know and understand that they may not know or understand or that we never have thought about. So we do want the spinoff from this study here, such a class. Thank you. That's a good thought. Okay? Any other comments or questions? Yes, sir. A little louder, Gary. Okay. Okay. No, the authority of the pastor rests in the position, but the manifestation of the authority, the expression of the authority, the application, that's the word I'm looking for, the application of the authority is in teaching, okay. Primarily. Mm-hmm. Right. True. But at the same time, that word obey is that Hebrews 13:17, obey them that have the rule over you. Okay? That word obey is a very interesting Greek word. It is translated in 2 Timothy 1, where it says, I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day by the word persuaded. In other words, the way that you submit in obedience to a person's authority is through his ability to persuade you of the validity of his teaching. You see? It's easy to obey somebody that you trust. And the best way to trust somebody is to be persuaded that they are teaching you what's right. You see? That's such a wonderful truth. And that's why the ministering servants in the church must free their teachers sufficiently to study and pray, to be qualified, to teach them adequately so that they can live spiritually. That's why it says the elders that rule well should be counted worthy of double honor. What that means is if you've got somebody in a position of leadership and he rules well, now the word rule there means to stand in front and lead. So if he stands in front and leads effectively, you do whatever you can to keep him doing that. That's what that means. You see, in other words, if you've got somebody who is really helping you, whatever you can do to help him help you helps everybody. You see? I've often said that it's almost impossible to help the leader too much. It is possible to help the leader too much. What kind of a scenario would you have if you were doing too much for your leader? If he was taking your help and indulging with it, okay? If he was taking what you gave him and using it for his own entertainment rather than your edification. You see? I mean, look, if every time you take, a pound of beef or a sack of flour and you give it to somebody and they cook it and feed others with it, you see? Well, then you're going to get the idea, be a pretty good investment to keep that person supplied. You see? But if every time you bring something like that to somebody, they cook it up, eat half of it, and throw the rest of it away and give none of it to anybody else, you wouldn't want to share something with somebody like that, would you? You see? So, when I say that teaching is the application of the pastor's authority. That's how the pastor, shall we say, wields his authority. Now, have you ever seen somebody who takes the authority and instead of using it effectively, they use it tyrannically? You know? And they love to be called of men Rabbi, Rabbi. And they love the uppermost seats at feasts. Matthew 23 has a lot to say about some folks like that, you see. And we have that today, too. You know, we could translate that today. They love to be called of men doctor, or something like that. You know, really, Baptist preachers and chiropractors are really bad about that. But, okay. Well, any other questions or comments about that? Okay. Let me read that sentence again. They shall function as practical ministers by taking care of the physical aspects of the ministry to free the pastors to give their full attention to their responsibilities as listed above. Now, go back with me in your mind to Acts chapter 6 for just a moment, where it says, it is not meet that we should leave the Word of God and serve tables. Okay? Therefore, look ye out among you, seven men of honest report, full of the Holy Ghost and wisdom, whom we may set over this business. Okay, now there are two words I want you to think about, table and business. Okay? The word table there is used in an application of the fact that the widows were being neglected in the daily distribution of food. Okay? The daily ministration, feeding, and so on. But it's not a table on which you eat. That word table is the table that the money changer used. It is translated bank in one of the Gospels. Thou shouldest have taken my money and put it in the bank, that when I come I might receive mine own with usury. That word bank is exactly the same as the word table in Acts chapter 6. Okay? So it's referring to the practical aspects, including the finances. And then when it says, whom we may set over this business, the word business does not originally mean business in the sense of buying and selling. It literally means busyness. Okay? Whom we may set over this busyness. Now, everybody knows that the job you have to do expands to fill the time available to do it. Right? If you have 2 hours to work, there will always be 2 hours of work. If you have 3 hours in which to do the same job, it will take 3 hours. You know. Now, the reason for that is because of the way we do the job and the quality of application of our energies. And if we have more time, we tend to focus more on details or work at a different pace or things like that. And that kind of thing is busyness. There are busy things that we can do, not busy work. Remember that? In school, they'd give you what they call busy work. Was that a waste of time? Sometimes, but not always. Sometimes it's allowing you to focus on some skill or spend a little bit more time developing some ability and that sort of thing, you see. But it's possible for us to be so wrapped up in things that with which we could be busy constantly, good things, but not the right things, you see. There are enough responsibilities of visitation, care of the sick, encouraging the discouraged, going to meetings, making decisions, selecting furniture, learning how to operate the computer system, correspondence, playing phone tag with other preachers, and all those kinds of things. There are enough things like that that we could do to fill all available time. See? You know, I hear this constantly. Pastor, you're so busy. Okay? Well, we ought to be busy. We ought to be busy. I would rather have people say to me, boy, Pastor, you're so busy, than to come to me and say, boy, Pastor, you're so idle. Yeah. You know? You have so much idle time. You see? Look, let me ask you a question. Does the busyness of a person's schedule have to do with the responsibilities he has or the responsibility he feels? It's the responsibility he feels. When a person accepts a great deal of responsibility, he will always be busy. Okay? He will always be actively involved in something. Okay? So, don't get to the place where you feel like, well, I can't bother him when he's busy, or I can't give a job to a busy man, or whether you're talking about anybody. Don't wait until somebody's idle to give them something to do. Because if somebody is idle, they won't do it. That's right. That's right. You know, you take a job to a busy man. You've heard that before. Okay, what does that mean? That means somebody who realizes that time is important and is wisely investing their time. Now, again, there's always a tendency, not always, but there's sometimes a tendency for people to get selfishly frustrated because they don't fully understand why a busy person, I'm not just talking about the pastor, I'm talking about anybody, why a busy person is busily engaged in the things they are involved in rather than the things that you think they ought to be involved in. Okay? Well, now, Dr. Bob said duties don't conflict. Yes, they do. That's not what Dr. Bob meant. When Dr. Bob Sr. said duties don't conflict, he did not mean that you and I should always be actively involved in what the other person thinks we should be actively involved in. You see, that's how we use that phrase. We go to somebody and they're doing something that we don't think they ought to be doing. We think they ought to be doing something else. And we say, well, now, you know, brother, duties don't conflict. In other words, I think this is your duty. This isn't your duty. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you really want to spend your life trying to decide what God's will is for somebody else? Don't we have enough trouble trying to figure out what God's will is for ourselves, you see, instead of trying to figure it out for somebody else? As Christian people, we need to give others the benefit of the doubt who are busily engaged in the Lord's work, assuming that God is well able to put them where He wants them to be, doing what He wants them to do. Now, is there ever going to be a time when we are going to get everything that could be done, that ought to be done, done so that we can sit back and enjoy it? Is that ever going to happen in this life? Never. Never. There will always be something else to do. Is it also a part of the responsibility of every Christian at times to do what appears to others to be nothing productive and take some quiet time to reflect and rest and meditate and spend time with the Lord? Yes, that's also important. Therefore, ultimately, to whom do we answer? We answer to God. Practically, to whom do we answer? To the people we're responsible to. Okay? Right. And there are going to be times when the people that we're responsible to and God and maybe us all have different opinions about what we should be doing at the moment. You see? And that's why when we say duties conflict, they really do. Our duty to God may conflict with our duty to man and may conflict with our perception of our duty ourselves. You see? And life consists of regularly seeking to know what God's priority for this moment is. You see? And Christian effectiveness consists of finding that out and doing it. You see? And sometimes that's a process of trial and error. But one key thing that the Lord has done is He has given us servants within the local church to take care of some of these things that must be done so that the pastor will not spend all of his time taking care of those things and can then focus on his primary responsibility, which is laboring in the Word of God and teaching and praying. And I got to tell you, I used to have a real problem with this, but I don't have as much of a problem as I used to with it. There are plenty of times when I am sitting at my desk at the house on Saturdays reading my Bible and praying for you while you are scurrying about busily outside working on the property, and I'm not feeling guilty. And I thank God for that. Because I used to. I really did. I felt like if I wasn't out there right beside you, that somehow I wasn't doing my job. You see? But it wasn't possible. It wasn't possible. So, I mean, if my wife is fixing a big meal for the family, I want her in the kitchen fixing that meal. You see? I want her in there doing that. And I'll try to help her with that. Yes, Chris? Yeah. That's right. Told the Levites, you don't get any land. You know, don't bother putting out a garden. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to serve and you're going to minister to the people. And their inheritance was the ministry. That was their possession. In a very practical sense, I rejoice in that. I really do. You know, we've often said how much we enjoy and love being right in the middle of it. Yesterday, we were over there at the house, and a couple of deacon groups were over there, and there were people just crawling all over the property, and we were just right in the middle of it, and we were just praising the Lord and rejoicing. That's a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I thank God for it. Okay, but again, remember, the deacon's response. Now, I'm trying to make a point here. At the same time that the deacon's ministry exists to help the pastors have their spiritual service and teaching responsibility, by the same token, the pastors should have the maturity to allow the deacons to take responsibility for things that they then are going to do in their way. Okay? And I think a lot of times, and some of you fellows who may be preparing for the ministry, you don't really help people by telling them when to breathe in and when to breathe out. And folks, that something has to be learned. Some of you who've been here for a few years, you've been watching me learn this. Okay? And you may remember a day when it was a lot harder than it still is for me to let things go and let other people do them the way that God has gifted them to do them. You see? And we have to learn that because we're sinful human beings. But when it says that they put the deacons over the table, they let them have the business responsibilities and the finances, and they let them make some of those decisions, and they made themselves accountable to those people. I was talking with young Jerry Howell this week, who was here, and he was asking us some questions, and he had read through some of our missions policies and some of the things in our Constitution. He asked me about this very passage that we're studying right now, and I was explaining it to him, and he had never heard of that concept before of leadership through accountability. And he says, well, what would keep the pastor under a circumstance like this from being a dictator? I said, accountability. Accountability is a whole lot better than authority. See, if I'm willing to be accountable to you, you're willing to be accountable to me. Now, if you don't believe that I'm going to be accountable to you, you're not going to trust me. And if you're going to trust me, there's nothing I can do to get you to follow me for long. Right? Why do I want you to follow me anyway? Because I think I know where God wants us to go. You see? Now, there are some people who want others to follow them so that will make them a leader. That's Jesse Jackson. See, his method of leadership is finding the parade and getting in front of it.
Yeah.
You see? That's what he does. He doesn't care where the parade's going. He just wants to be in front. Isn't it right? Put up a news camera, he appears, you know, and he has some comment to make on it. And I'm not picking on the guy because of the particular things he believes. I'm just saying that's a foolish method, you see. And there are a lot of people in leadership that are that way. Sometimes people want a position of leadership because of the title that goes with it. And that's foolishness. That's foolishness. All right. Now, deacons' meetings and committees and so on, the pastor shall determine when it's necessary for the deacons to act in concert, shall outline with them an agenda of business to be discussed. Committees of deacons for research and recommendation shall be authorized and shall work under the leadership of one or more pastors. We have a deacons' meeting once a month. We meet for breakfast in three different groups, and then every fourth month we meet together as a whole group. This past Thursday afternoon, the pastors and the deacon chairman met together, and we talked about the agenda for the meeting. And we analyzed the needs of the congregation. And I'll just be frank with you. We went through the church directory. We talked about the people that we know of that have needs. We prayed about those needs. And we tried to determine if there's anything the particular deacon who's assigned to that family could do to help them, or if it was something we needed to take care of ourselves. We went through the whole congregation that way. And then we talked about the committee reports. And we talked about the building program. We got the agenda all put together. We got together early Saturday morning for breakfast. We had breakfast together, had some fellowship, had a Bible study. And then we talked about the business and went to work day. That's what deacons and pastors do. Okay? And then every other month, we get together in three groups. First month, the first-year deacons meet with one pastor. Second-year deacons meet with the other pastor. Third-year deacons will meet, say, with me. And then the next month, we rotate. So that for 3 months in a row, we each meet with the fellows who are in their first, second, or third year of service as deacon. And then we all get back together as a group again. Then we rotate through it again. And you say, why do you do that? It's just what we thought up. Okay? Didn't have any verses on that. It just seemed like a good idea. Okay? We've done it other ways. And we may do it some other way in the future. Okay. Then there are a number of little offices here. I shouldn't have used that phrase. I don't mean to minimize the importance of it. There are a number of other things that I'm not going to treat in as much detail. That's what I'm trying to say, as there are others. Oh, by the way, you know, when we use words like that, little, or things like that, that kind of, it sounds like we're demeaning. Did you read a passage this week where the people were angry with the Lord and he sent the fiery serpents in among them? Okay, did you know the snakes weren't burning? They were not on fire? They were fiery serpents. You know why I call them fiery serpents? Because the bite burned. The bite burned. It caused a tremendous burning sensation. That particular serpent that's referred to. And it was very lethal. Okay? But you remember what they said when they said, our soul loatheth this light bread? What do they want? Wheat bread? Why do they call it light bread? You might know. What does the word light mean in that verse? I mean, huh? Worthless. Worthless. Light. Nothing to it. This is nothing. It's just, it's a light thing. It's meaningless. Worthless. Does that add a little meaning to why the Lord said, okay, fine, we're going to deal with you. So he sent fiery serpents in among them. Don't want the manna? Here, have a little snake. Is that what he said? No. No. It was not just the fact that they were grumbling a little bit. They were saying that that which God had provided was absolutely without value. You see? And that adds a different shade of meaning to it, doesn't it? So, I was thinking about that when I used that word little a minute ago. I don't mean to say these things are without value, because they certainly are with value. But we talk about a church clerk. Now, we do have a church clerk here. Does anybody know who our church clerk is? Yeah, Elaine does. Anybody else know? Who's the church clerk? No? Pastor Dixon, okay? In other words, what is a church clerk? That's the guy that signs the second line on all the legal documents, okay? You have the president. Who's the president? Does anybody know who the president is? Me, okay? Why? Because I have to sign on one of the lines too. That's all that means, okay? So somebody has to be the president of the corporation. Somebody has to be the clerk of the corporation. The clerk has the legal responsibility to make sure that the documents are in order. That's all that means, okay? And we've already said that the pastors will be the corporate officers. So the church clerk shall be a pastor whose duty shall be to ensure that accurate records of business meetings and an up-to-date membership roll are maintained. Now, do you mean Pastor Dixon takes the minutes of the meetings? No, but he has the responsibility to see to it that's done. Now, who actually takes the minutes of the meetings? My secretary. Okay? Why? Because that works. Okay? Because that works best. He shall sign financial and church documents as clerk. Staff secretaries will generally perform the routine duties of the clerk. That's just a practical matter, but the official office has to exist. Why does that have to be in the church constitution? Okay? This is a corporate document. This is the document on which we are in, by which we are incorporated legally. And you have to determine in your corporate document who's responsible for what legal responsibility. That's why that's in here. Concerning a treasurer. The treasurer shall function as the business manager of the church. He shall be appointed by the pastors. His term of office shall be indefinite. He shall have authority to receive, disperse, and manage all money belonging to the church or committed to its trust in accordance with the budget or approved programs of the church. He shall keep accurate records of all receipts and expenditures and make regular quarterly reports of the church. He shall ensure that the financial records are audited annually. He shall prepare financial reports for the senior pastor and project budget adjustments when necessary. He shall collect and verify information necessary for the preparation of the church budget. He shall have the assistance of staff secretaries or bookkeepers as available and necessary. Does anybody know who our treasurer is? Who is it? Sam Smith is. Sam Smith's our treasurer. Now, we don't call him the treasurer. What do we call him? Business manager. Why? Because there's a whole lot more to it than that. Now, he has a lot of people that help him that are ultimately or immediately responsible to him. We have a financial secretary who is an employee of the church. Okay? Jim manages all the books, and he prepares the check. He signs the checks, and then Sam signs them too. Okay, they both sign them. Now, there are others of us who are legally authorized to sign checks who wisely do not sign checks. Okay, I haven't signed a check in I don't know how long. I think I'm allowed to legally, but I don't do it because other people ought to do that. Okay, I don't need to be doing that kind of thing. And besides that, how would you feel if I was in there writing checks all the time? That'd disturb you a little bit, wouldn't it? Should. Okay, I don't need to be involved in that. By the same token, what happens to the money? Do you know what happens to the money when we take the offering? Well, they take it away. Somebody has to handle that. All right, they take it back there, and a team of fellows count it. No one person counts it by himself. They count it. They record it on a form. And then it's locked up. And then it's taken to the bank. with a secure means, okay? And then the next day, the financial secretary goes to the bank, and in the presence of the bank officer, since the bank now has the control of the money, in the presence of the bank officer, verifies the count and records that. And then the deposit is officially recorded, okay? And the money is put where it's supposed to be. And there are all kinds of means that are set up for handling those kinds of funds. Now, we're handling close to, if not over, $1 million a year around here. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of change. That's a lot of cash. That's a lot of checks. And sometimes things don't always happen the way you think they ought to happen. So that's why we've set up as many systems of accountability as we possibly can. That's why it's important to use the numbered envelope system. Sometimes folks will want a particular gift to go to a particular thing, and they'll write on their check for whatever. Well, that little line down the lower left-hand side of your check, that's to tell you when a check comes back from the bank what you did with it. That's not to tell the counting team what to do with it. You see? Sometimes people assume if they write on a check that the money's going to go where they wrote on there. Sometimes they'll see it. But you got to imagine now, when they're back there counting $15,000, $20,000, that's easy to miss. Right? So a whole lot better system is to have another piece of paper that can be maintained, because that other stuff is going to the bank. And unless they jot it down right then when they're trying to, and they want to get that finished so they can get in and participate in the service too, see? So you need to use the numbered envelope, because that way, that doesn't go to the bank, that goes to the business office. And all it has on it is the number, and then the financial secretary sees that and maintains that record and transfers that to the computer program that will then apply it to your account. You see? That's important. And by the way, if I'm not mistaken, starting this year, actually 93's taxes, you can no longer use canceled checks alone to verify for your taxes. You have to have either a numbered envelope, record, or a written receipt in order to verify a contribution to charity or a church. Yes, sir? Over 500, 500 or over? 250? 250. Okay. Yeah. So for a contribution less than that, you can use a canceled check or something like that. Okay. Yeah. But even still, they're cracking down on those kinds of things and making it a little more difficult for us there. Okay. Well, I don't want to minimize our emphasis on this. We got just a couple more minutes. Does anybody have a question or about the treasurer or that sort of thing? We'll talk a little bit more about the finances and the business and why we do those kinds of things the way we do. You know, some years ago, for example, now it's easy. Sometimes people take offense when no offense is intended. And we ought to grow out of that. You know, give people the benefit of the doubt. But some years ago, we had a situation, and don't try to figure out who I'm talking about, but we had a situation where I had put the counting team concept into effect, and we had a person who said, well, the counting team's making mistakes. I don't want to use the counting team anymore. So we had a person who's no longer here, and you wouldn't know the person anyway. And this person said, we're not going to use accounting teams anymore. And so this individual said, we'll have so-and-so here count the money. And that way it'll be accurate. So this person was in the room alone counting the money. When I found out about that, I said, you know, that's a bad idea. I said, how could you defend yourself against an accusation of deception? How could you ever defend yourself if somebody said, how do we know that person's not stealing money? So this person goes to this other person and says, the pastor says you're stealing money. They might as well have been. Okay, they got that attitude, you see. Now, that's unfortunate. But you see, the reason, that's not accountability. Accountability says two, three people get together and count the money. Okay? You say, well, don't you trust each other? That's not the point. The point is, you must not only be trustworthy, you must be seen to be trustworthy. You see, it must be obvious that you're trustworthy. You see, everybody must know that you're trustworthy. Now, when people, you know, that's not accountability. When somebody says, well, if you can't trust me, maybe you better get somebody else for the job. Maybe we had. You see?
Avoid that appearance.
That's right. Yeah, listen, you don't even put yourself in a position where somebody can accuse you of something and you can't defend yourself against it. We have all kinds of other policies like that in our church. Every office door has a window in it. Why? Because we're afraid our people are going to get back there and be naughty. Right? No. We want everybody to know that there's no opportunity for such a thing. We have another rule. Every now and then we'll violate this inadvertently, but it's a general policy. We tell the men, Don't go behind the lady's desk. Don't go and stand behind somebody and look over their shoulder. Don't be in that environment. If you go into one of the lady's offices, stand in front of her desk. Don't go around behind her desk where she's working. Now, let me ask you a question. Regardless of how pure people are, if you walk into somebody's office and you see somebody standing around behind their desk with their hand on the chair leaning over, you know, don't you feel like that's a little inappropriate? Doesn't that promote things in your mind that you think, boy, so we just say, hey, don't do that, don't do that. Now, we don't fire people over things like we might if it became a problem, okay? We just set up policies like that. It's just so much wiser. When don't ever do it? You know, do the things that you need to do to maintain accountability. You know, don't, so somebody's got a problem with their car. Don't take one of the, tell the men, don't take one of the ladies in your car for any reason. Don't go in their car for any reason. Yeah, but her car was broke down. Well, go get your wife and come back and get her. You know? Or take somebody else. Get another person. Get one of your kids to go with you. Or something like that. Just avoid the problem. Don't let those kinds of things happen. You see? So there are a whole bunch of little policies like that and guidelines that we've established to maintain propriety in business and personal areas like that. Okay? Don't ever put yourself in a place of temptation. Don't put yourself in a place where somebody might even think that you might be getting tempted. Okay? All right, we'll talk about this more a little bit later, okay? Father, thank you now for the time. Thank you for the lessons here. Pray you'd help us to continue to learn not just what we do, but why we do it. Help us as we continue this move now. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.